Thank you for tuning in to the WOLA podcast, Latin America Today. It's Friday, May 11th, 2018. I'm Adam Isaacson. I'm the Director of Defense Oversight here at WOLA, and I usually run these podcasts. I'm here today with WOLA's Director for the Andes, Jimena Sanchez. Hello, Jimena.
Hello.
And our Assistant Director for Venezuela, Jeff Ramsey. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Now, let's start with you, Jeff, because you spent the entire month of April, pretty much, in Venezuela, and also in Venezuelan border regions in Colombia and in Brazil. And Jimena, you traveled to Colombia for part of the month, and you both met up, right, in the border city of Cúcuta?
That's right.
But that's a lot to talk about, especially given all that's going on. Let's start with just, you know, you had a much better look at Venezuela than almost anybody in the United States right now. I mean, what did you see? What did you come away with?
Yeah, so I spent about 2.5 weeks in Caracas, during which time I also did some traveling to the outskirts of the city and to, you know, a couple day trips outside of Caracas. And, you know, in general, I think the country's in a weird wait-and-see situation. People don't exactly expect any kind of change to come out of the May 20th elections. I mean, it's pretty clear that the electoral conditions are far from guaranteed, and nobody really expects anything other than a Maduro victory. That being said, the polls do suggest that opposition candidate Henry Falcón could pull off a win, despite the prospect of fraud, if there was enough participation, if he was able to mobilize the opposition base. Now he's being sort of frustrated in these efforts by the traditional opposition, which has declared an electoral boycott. And all that is to say that, you know, I think if you speak to everyday Venezuelans, all that sort of translates into a dynamic where they are there's sort of this mass apathy. You know, I think people, things have changed from a year ago. You know, a year ago in 2017, there were there was a 3-month wave of protests. People were sort of expecting things to change in the short term, and I think people now are increasingly resigned to the idea that this political and economic crisis could last months or even years.
But help me with this mass apathy thing. I mean, I'm outside Venezuela. I see that, you know, inflation this year could be over 100,000%. You know, you've got people with not even able to meet their minimum caloric needs every day. Is it really that bad, A? And B, if it is, how could there be mass apathy?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, the economic crisis is very real. I mean, when I was there, when I first arrived in early April, the dollar on the parallel exchange rate was around 200,000 bolivares. Mm-hmm. And when I left 2.5 weeks later, it was over twice that. It got to about 550,000 bolivares. Mm-hmm. There is widespread scarcity of basic goods and medicine. You know, people are dying of treatable diseases. There was a study that came out a couple months ago that found that 80% of the population is living in poverty. People are losing weight. I mean, the conditions are very bad. And that's not to say that people aren't upset about it. I mean, they certainly are. But I think people are there's no immediate political solution on the horizon for people. And I think that's sort of translating to a sense of desperation. I mean, I spoke with I went to a rally that was organized by families of the youths who were killed in the 2017 protests, and I spoke with three different mothers of victims, and every one of them, voiced the criticism of the government that you would expect, but they also reserved a degree of criticism of the traditional opposition. There is this idea that here we are a year later, and things haven't changed, and the political opposition appears to be sort of consistently maneuvering and not necessarily offering much in the way of alternatives. Another example, I met with a young student who was actually an organizer of some of the protests last year, and she was telling me that it's increasingly difficult for her to go to rallies because, you know, she gets approached by mothers and older Venezuelans who embrace her and tell her that she's the future of the country. But she, like so many other Venezuelans I talk to under the age of 30, is making plans to get out of the country. She plans on leaving to study in Chile by the end of the year.
So, yeah, rather than any political process, there people are just going to vote with their feet. And so this is something you both saw in the border areas. What does that look like?
Well, it's rather astonishing to see how the number of people crossing the border has increased so much just since the last time I was there, which was about 2 years ago. And one thing that is important to highlight is that it's several different groups that are crossing the border. So you have a population that is fleeing basically the humanitarian crisis. Most people who are doing that includes people who are about 60% pretty highly educated and have special skills. But it also includes people who don't have the means to be able to travel to other parts of Europe or the U.S. And so they're finding Colombia as sort of their transitory point to go to until they can find the means to go south, either to Chile or to Argentina or go north to even Canada, U.S. And Europe, mostly Spain and Italy. You have a Colombo-Venezuelan mixed population, right. Which it gets tricky because you have some children that don't have documentation, so that's a problem.
Wow.
And then you also have a number of Colombians that are returning after the 52-year-old conflict. Those are different categories. You have people who are basically returning refugees, and then you have people who are migrants that were used to going back and forth, usually benefiting more from the exchange rates with Venezuela at a certain point, now finding it that they need to be in Colombia. So I think the first issue, which has been the trickiest one, has been the issue of documentation and registration. So initially, Colombia set up a special permanence permit in 2017, and in 2017 and 2018, they opened up two inscription periods where approximately 69,000 Venezuelans, and by this I mean purely Venezuelans, received it. With that permit, people were able to work and to get access to health providers, although it's important to understand that the system of health in Colombia has had a lot of corruption issues and has nearly collapsed in recent years. So what we are seeing is mostly just very basic health. And so for people...
And that's for 69,000 people?
Yes. Okay. For people who've had chronic malnutrition or people who've had long-term diseases or who are elderly or have special needs and haven't been getting the attention they need in Venezuela and are in a dire state, this is not very good. So President Santos visited the border in February, basically to try to get a sense of what's going on. And after that happened, they set up something called the Special Migration Group, which is basically in charge of controlling the flow of Venezuelans into Colombia, trying to establish some kind of order and registering them with Defensoría and Registraduría. There's also a very big growing number of people from Venezuela in desperate situation bringing in illegal foodstuffs like milk and meat, and so they do a lot of confiscation of that. The other situation that we're seeing is that there really isn't any spaces for these folks. There are shelters that we visited. One is set up by the Colombian government and the Red Cross, but it's only for people who actually have relatives in Colombia and are just going to stay there 1 or 2 days. So it was nearly empty, this beautiful shelter with all of this capacity. And right outside the shelter, you just saw people crowding in the streets. And that's generating a lot of problems. People are either forced to live under bridges, live in the middle of the street, or pay money for, housing that just means, sleeping on someone's floor. And that's generating a situation which is really problematic. It's giving the perception to Colombians that insecurity has gone up. It's putting them in a vulnerable state. where they're caught up between some of the fights between the different illegal armed groups that are present in the area. So a couple people mentioned to us that they had to run because there were shootouts, that kind of thing. And it's also facilitating labor exploitation as well as prostitution in those areas.
So those are all the services that are available to this population right now. What, just, I mean, what how big is this population in Colombia?
Well, according to Migration Colombia and the IOM, the population is actually that's been coming in. They said for to be about 550,000 Venezuelan citizens. And then that doesn't include the people returning to the country. They're estimating
Colombians returning to the country
or mixed populations. They're saying that it's a growing number, about 30,000 people per month that are actually staying in Colombia. Mm-hmm. The ones that are staying in Colombia are either staying in Cúcuta or traveling to Santa Marta, Barranquilla, Cartagena, Bogota, Medellin, Cali. It depends on if they're able to travel. It's very expensive for people to travel because all of the buses and transport agencies in the area have jacked up the prices to some ridiculous amount of money. So it's very hard for people to leave the border area.
But you're looking at probably more than 300,000 Venezuelans a year deciding to stay in Colombia, which is about 1% of Venezuela's population right there. Mm-hmm. And xenophobia, you mentioned a little that people are tired of what they perceive as nuisance crime and other things from Venezuelan citizens.
Well, Colombia and Venezuela have always had a very cordial, friendly relationship, and Colombians are appreciative of Venezuela for always taking them in.
It took about 2 million Colombians,
yeah,
right, during the
and
conflict.
So, in general, there's a very good sense. However, I think that that sense of welcoming is getting strained due to various reasons. Colombia has its own issues, especially with unemployment and with services not reaching Colombians living along the border areas in particular. Mm-hmm. Colombia is really having a hard time implementing the post-conflict.
Yes.
So you have the situation whereby the ELN is actively recruiting in that area, and we've heard from multiple sources that they're actively recruiting Venezuelan youth. So there is a perception of insecurity based on that. And then in general, there's been an increase, if you look at the Fiscalía numbers, of criminality along the border. And so people attribute that to the Venezuelans. The other issue that is leading to some xenophobic sentiment is the idea that Venezuelans who are in desperate situations, mostly in cities, are turning to drugs. And so that drug addiction is leading to this idea that these people are coming into this area. And that they're also willing to work for less than what Colombians can work for. So they're a competition in terms of some of the jobs in the informal sector.
Right.
Yeah, I saw this on the Brazilian side as well. I mean, it is really kind of jarring to hear some of the same arguments used against Venezuelan migrants that we hear here in the United States against, particularly Central Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Things like they're taking our jobs, they're bringing in crime. I mean, it's almost Trumpian.
I've heard this in our migration work in Mexico, in some Mexico City suburbs where Central American migrants pass through. Mm. They don't want them there, and it does sound very similar.
Yeah.
But Jeff, you were in Boa Vista, Brazil, right? That's in Roraima, near the border. What did that look like?
I think it is a different situation in Brazil. I mean, for one thing, they're receiving far less. The UNHCR estimates that about 4,000 Venezuelans cross into the Colombian border every day. By contrast, only about 800 cross into Brazil every day. So the scale is less.
Right.
But there is still that same pressure on local services, on health services, the local economy, etc. But the Brazilian authorities have responded, I would say, in a much more, relatively speaking, a more humanitarian way. In Brazil, you can still cross into the country if you're Venezuelan with just your cédula, your national ID card. Uh-huh. And it's a lot easier to seek refugee status and to seek temporary residency as well. Mm-hmm. And so in general, you don't see the same pressures that you see in Colombia that force Venezuelans into the informal sector. That being said, unemployment in Boavista, just like in Cúcuta, is extremely high. So you still have a large share of these Venezuelan migrants working in the informal sector. On the shelters, the government of Brazil has responded more favorably than in Colombia. There are when I visited, there were 7 shelters, 5 in the city of Boavista. And 2 right directly in Pacaraima, a small town about 2 mm-hmm. hours north, directly on the border. Now, I think...
These are not run by humanitarian organizations, are they? Or are they the military?
They are coordinated by humanitarian organizations like the UNHCR. There's an organization called the International Fraternity. However, they're sort of... coordinated in deep partnership with the military. So that is the major problem with the Brazilian response is that the military has been placed in charge of the national government's response. They are in charge of logistics, of moving medicine, aid around, coordinating construction of the shelters. They are in charge of security at the shelters. And that is... not a role that you would think is ideal for the military. And human rights groups that I met with were very critical of this dynamic, particularly in the shelters that are meant for indigenous Venezuelans that are fleeing from the eastern Orinoco Delta.
Wow.
I actually heard repeated complaints of the military not respecting these indigenous groups' cultures, not engaging with community leaders, the caciques. Mm-hmm. And I actually had this confirmed directly. I actually went to an indigenous shelter in Pacaraima directly on the Venezuelan border and met with an army captain who showed me around. And he taught me a new word in Portuguese. He was describing the indigenous in the shelter as gafanhotos. And my Portuguese is passable, but it's not excellent. And so I was having some trouble understanding. And he was like, yeah, they're gafanhotos. They come, they eat, they move on. And I was like, oh, are you saying that, these Warao indigenous people from the east of Venezuela are nomads? Are you saying they're a nomadic people? And he was like, no, here. And he put it into Google Translate on his cell phone. And gafanhoto, it turns out, means locust.
Locust.
So he was describing these indigenous Venezuelans as locusts, saying that they're taking advantage of state resources and don't have any interest in providing for themselves long term. The big push right now in the Brazilian response to Venezuelan migration is interiorization. So encouraging the 70,000 Venezuelans that are estimated to be clustered in the state of Roraima along the northern border to seek employment or sort of more midterm economic prospects in the larger cities to the south.
Which are much more prosperous,
and where the likelihood of them finding some kind of formal employment is higher, though it's still not great. But authorities in Brazil are so that is sort of the long term prospect. But authorities in Brazil are that I spoke with are skeptical, including the military, are skeptical of including the indigenous communities in this process. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's hard to see. I mean, there are concerns about matching them up with job prospects, etc. But ultimately, from what I saw, a lot of that just seems chalked up to outright discrimination.
So it's happening in both places, this discrimination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense that Venezuelans who do cross into either country are at least eating better? That there's some improvement in their standard of living, even if they're living in the informal sector and living under bridges.
Yeah, I had, I met with, when I was in Boavista, I saw a guy still in his PDVSA, that's the state oil company in Venezuela, uniform, selling limes on the street.
Wow.
And the image was just, it was crazy because PDVSA, working at PDVSA as a technician, which I ended up talking to this guy.
Yeah.
I I went up and talked to him, and he described how, yeah, up until 3 years ago, he was a technician for PDVSA and was able to provide for his family in the eastern city of El Tigre. Mm-hmm. But as a result of the economic crisis, I mean, his savings got eaten up by hyperinflation. He, you know, his state salary just wouldn't let him make ends meet. So now he sleeps in the streets of Boavista and sells limes to passing motorists. And he told me he's able to actually send more money back to his family in El Tigre to support them than he did on his state salary. And I heard this over and over from different mm-hmm. people.
Yeah, and in Cúcuta, I mean, there are some Colombians that are stepping up to the plate, in particular the Catholic Church. We visited a comedor that feeds about 1,500 Venezuelans every day. Initially, it was set up through volunteer donations, and now it's becoming more formalized with the help of the World Food Program, NRC, and others. Hmm. And so that at least helps lactating women, women, children, and elderly people. Whatever's left to eat is then given to men. Mm-hmm. The reason being that there are a lot of tensions between the men, and so to minimize that and to make sure that the most vulnerable people get fed first.
It looks like the humanitarian community has, you know, had to rush, or they weren't maybe prepared for this because mm-hmm. it's not a natural disaster; it's a man-made disaster. Yeah. But they maybe are catching up somewhat with this now, or at least they're mm-hmm. getting the word out that they need more resources. The United yeah. States has pledged a certain amount, which I can't even keep track because the announcements keep coming in a piecemeal yeah. way. What is being done?
Okay, well, the overall regional response really has been a problem. Mm-hmm. The focus has really been politically on the Lima group and seeing what can be done inside of Venezuela, mm-hmm. but not really taking the appropriate actions needed in terms of displacement. There is one problem, which is the categorization of persons. How do you categorize them? Are they forced migrants, or are they refugees? I would argue that most of them are forced migrants, although they have the right to apply for refugee status. So the capacity of the UNHCR to be able to determine who is a refugee and who isn't is something that needs to happen. Colombia has a particular problem in terms of being able to absorb folks. One, it's not a country that's used to receiving refugees. And so in terms of the refugee numbers, it's always had a very low number of folks that actually are granted that status from the world. And then Colombia really has migration legislation, which is completely outdated and is needs to be completely reformed. Added to that, while Colombia is a country that has always had a really active civil society that always takes the reins in a lot of these problems, that civil society has been focused for the past 15 or more years on the internal displacement problem right. in the country and hasn't really caught up to how to deal with this situation, mm-hmm. although they are trying. That's actually really needed so that you can figure out exactly the different categories, the different types of attentions needed for people. Now, the U.S. has pledged at least $46 million, but it really falls short. Mm-hmm. And it falls short on several different things. Well, first, the number of people is much greater and much more needed. There was a person at the Brookings Institution, Danny Bahar, who recently estimated that the cost of a quote-unquote refugee is about $2,500 per person per year. So mm-hmm. if we're looking at that, that really falls short. And also, the question is, where is that money going to? So if the money is going to go to USAID, is USAID then going to subcontract it to IOM? And then IOM, which does a wonderful job at basically determining the level of the problem and dealing with the registration issue. For example, now they're involved in this mass registration effort that tries to figure out the needs that's going to end in the next month. But they're not really a humanitarian agency that gives the assistance needed directly to people. So you really need to have a working group like you would in other situations that includes folks on the protection issue for the refugees, folks on the food issue, which is the World Food Program, folks on the documentation issue, which is really IOM, and then local institutions in the country absorbing them so that they can be reintegrated or integrated into the country, into the economy long term. The other issue that is really important to consider is the United States and other countries in the region, because of the United States, are restricting their migration policies. So we're seeing in Argentina more restrictions, Chile more restrictions, even Brazil in terms of for people to be able to enter. And in the U.S., the ideal thing to do would be to have a temporary protected status for Venezuelans who've already come here. However, TPS overall is being ended for almost all of the populations that have it currently. So I think there isn't the political will to really achieve that. But if the U.S. really wanted to assist it, it should consider a special category for the Venezuelans.
Now, Venezuelans are already the number one country for asylum applications in the United States.
Yeah.
Actually, by quite a bit. Just finally, you know, it seems that, Jeff, that your impression from being inside Venezuela is that despite hyperinflation, despite, you know, there's not, you know, despite the conditions going on and the likelihood that it's going to get worse, that they're likely just to keep muddling through. We probably won't expect a collapse or a coup or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the trouble with predicting anything in Venezuela is that things, you know, conditions can change so quickly. But, you know, it is true that people have been predicting the imminent collapse of the government for 5-6 years now, and we haven't seen it. Right. I mean, I think that from the perspective of the Venezuelan government, they see this almost as their Cuban special period, you know,
right.
What Cuba went through in the 90s. And I think
after
they
the
see
Soviet
this
Union.
Exactly after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think they see this as something that they need to weather, to sort of dig in and get through in order to advance their political project long term. Having said that, you know, I do think there are important incentives to find some kind of negotiated, peaceful solution to the current political crisis.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to imagine this government continuing to go down the path that it's on without having to rely increasingly on repression and even more brutal measures to stay in power than we've seen so far.
Right.
You know, I do think there is going to be increasing mobilization in the coming years, in the coming months following the election, as the economic crisis worsens. And I would not be surprised if we saw some kind of mediation process or formal negotiations resume in the coming months.
And what would be to negotiate? Just the exit, sort of a soft landing, maybe something like transitional justice for...
That's the hope. I mean, you know, I think any kind of... I think if there is going to be a transition in Venezuela, it's going to have to be a pacted transition. I mean, this is not a government that's going to sign up to go to jail.
Right.
You know, and I think the government is unfortunately going to need some kind of guarantee. They're going to seek some kind of guarantees before handing over the keys. And... You know, I think those of us who are following this issue, you know, we want to see some kind of transition, and we don't want to see an amnesty for some of the grave human rights violations that we've seen in Venezuela in the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think we also understand that in order for there to be a realistic transition, the government is going to need some sign that there won't be what they would characterize as a witch hunt. It's sort of similar to the dynamic behind the peace process in Colombia.
Right, that same problem. People will simply give away
yes.
what power they have just to go to jail.
Right.
Before we go, I just want to clarify one more point about the amount of U.S. assistance, because we keep hearing these announcements. I think just last week, Deputy Secretary Sullivan, this week maybe, said gave a figure of $21 million. What are the needs and what's the United States giving?
Okay, well, we're not completely sure the total number that the United States is giving.
Mm-hmm.
The $46 million number that I mentioned earlier was really for UNHCR's appeal for this year alone, which appears to be an appeal that only got about 6% anyhow. So we'll have to check back on those numbers.
Right, but it's the United States is granting, at least to Colombia, numbers in the double digits of millions this year from emergency refugee funds.
Yeah, in mid-April, the government announced that they would give some $13 million to the Venezuelan, the response to the Venezuelan migration mm-hmm. refugee situation. And then that was said to be in addition to $2.5 million
right.
specifically for Colombia. But we've seen different numbers. We've seen, you know, a series of different announcements now, different figures. We're still trying to chase down exactly how much the U.S. government is committing to this. Whatever it is, I mean, I do think that even the UNHCR appeal, as Jimena and I were just saying, it's absurdly low considering the scale of humanitarian need on the ground.
Right. I guess you know you all are working on a memo or a commentary that will go up on our website soon, which will include our best estimate of that figure. Hey, thank you, Jeff and Jimena.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's it for now. Thank you for listening to WOLA's Latin America Today. Please keep listening and please keep visiting WOLA's website, www.wola.org. You can also find us on Facebook or on Twitter at WOLA_ORG.